Hi, this is Uncle Bob, and you're listening to the Pragmatic Podcast.
Welcome to the Pragmatic Podcast for December 8th, 2010. An interview with Jonathan Rasmussen, author of The Agile Samurai. I'm your host, Miles Forrest. My guest today is Jonathan Rasmussen, who has a new book out called The Agile Samurai. Jonathan is a developer with an intense interest in everything. A former Agile coach at ThoughtWorks, he used to travel extensively introducing teams to Agile software delivery. He has since settled down in Calgary, Canada, and now coaches his son's hockey team. When not riding his bike in the Calgary winters or prototyping his latest startup idea, you can find him sharing his insights and opinions on software delivery on his blog at agilewarrior.wordpress.com. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi, great to be here, Miles.
So you've got this new book, full titled is The Agile Samurai, How Agile Masters Deliver Great Software. Can you just tell us briefly what the book's about?
Yeah, basically it's a book that just, it's an introduction to Agile for people who just are either considering getting into it or they've heard about it and they want to take the plunge. It's basically a great summary of just everything that you need to get to basically kick off, execute, and successfully deliver your Agile project. So what's new in there for some people is the first third is really dedicated to one area that Agile's been really completely silent on, and that's project chartering, or how do you kick off a project. So there's a tool in there called the Agile Inception Deck that we used a lot at ThoughtWorks, which really helped us sort of get things on track. And then basically we just take them through the planning, the stories, the estimation. And it's really like six books condensed down into one. That was one thing I've really found frustrating going to a client site is I always had to bring six books with me and say, read these. You know, we worked very hard just to distill everything you need to sort of get going. And yeah, that's kind of what the book's about.
Now, you had a lot of fun, even with the title, The Agile Samurai, and you use the metaphor of a sensei. And having read the book, I mean, it really works. You've done a really nice job.
Well, thank you. Some of the stuff, as hard as it might be for you or I to believe, some people don't find the stuff exciting. So you can write a book on, you know, whether you call it software project management or software delivery. I mean, you can really make this stuff dry and boring. And I'm just kind of a believer in that you just got to make this fun for people in a way. And I'm a big fan of Kathy Sierra. I was really influenced by the Head First series and, you know, just basically trying to figure out how to make some of these ideas stick in a fun and entertaining and engaging way was what sort of led to the samurai theme. And we try to have fun throughout the book using that theme just to sort of keep people awake and engaged and, you know, have some fun and not take the stuff too seriously.
So you mentioned right in the opening of the book, you jump right into sort of 6 points in the opening of your book. I just kind of wanted to touch on. So point number one, you say you break the big problems down into smaller ones. That seems fairly obvious. Can you elaborate a little bit more, though, what sort of the details of breaking a problem down?
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the hardest things when you're introducing someone to Agile is how do you come up with that sort of simple, clear, concrete statement? So I was really thinking hard about what's the metaphor if, you know, I didn't want to get into the manifesto or the principles. And I really landed on this idea of just deliver something of value every week. Because if you really just forget the word agile, forget about, you know, waterfall or methodologies or anything, what would I have to do to deliver something of value every week? If you think of software delivery from that point of view, you're really steered towards doing certain things. The one you touched on is you got to take big problems and break them down into smaller ones. So you can't take that 2 year, 1 year, 6 month, you know, thing and just tackle it all at once. You've got to break it down into smaller things where I'm really getting to user stories. So that's sort of the first point.
And the second point you have is focus on the really important stuff and forget everything else.
Yeah, because people get so excited about, you know, we've really trained business and customers to throw the kitchen sink at us when they're gathering requirements for their projects. So because they're, you know, traditionally given one shot to gather the requirements, one shot to get everything in there. So they hit you with everything they got because they know you're going to have a expensive change control process down the stream to remove change from the process. If you want to deliver something of value every week, you can't worry about the stuff, you know, 3, 6, 9 months down the road, at least not in great detail. So just focus on the now, like this week, what's the most important thing I can deliver? And just don't sweat the other stuff until you get there, because you're going to be way smarter down the road anyways. You're going to understand what's actually needed, and you do a much better job executing anyways.
Yeah, I suppose if people are coming from a traditional waterfall method or methodology, they're used to gathering all the requirements and packing everything in. And
absolutely.
You know, that's completely counterintuitive to what Agile preaches and teaches. Point number three, you say you make sure that what you are delivering works.
Yeah. And this, I mean, what's funny is if you introduce people who aren't really familiar with software to how we've traditionally done it, they would just be flabbergasted that so often we don't even test what we build. And this is just a call out that if you're going to deliver something of value every week, you've obviously got to test it. I mean, I know that seems obvious, but that notion of thinking that testing is going to come somewhere down the line, either in the latter stages of the project. I mean, even people who are really the hardcore waterfallists, if that's a word, they understand you can't test that late in the game. So this is just a pure call out to say, you've got to test now as we're going, because it's too late to try to build quality in after the fact.
Point number four, you go looking for feedback.
Yes. Yeah. And this is just a call out to basically say, you know, you want people to try whatever it is you're cooking and just see if they like what you're producing. So in a 1 week stint, by getting that feedback, whether it's your customer or someone you think can, whoever's guiding the delivery or telling you what they need, you want to get that feedback early and often. So you're not going off on a tangent. You're not building on top of stuff that doesn't work. And the sooner you can incorporate that in, the better.
And point number five, you change course when necessary.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I know this sounds obvious to most people who just hear this, but you'd be surprised how many project managers and people sometimes leading projects really get wed to that original plan where, you know, the stats that 80% of our projects are over time and over budget. And our industry's got a really terrible reputation when it comes to delivery. I think in a lot of those cases, just the plan was wrong. And people just refuse to change the plan. So, you know, it's much better to change your plan to map reality than try to hammer reality into your incorrect plan. So I encourage people not to try to change reality and change their plans instead.
And the last point is you become accountable. What is that?
Yeah. This is really about taking ownership of what you're delivering. So this isn't thinking that you're going to pass quality down the line. You're going to let someone else worry about setting expectations or schedule. It's really a mindset that you just want to approach delivery every week of delivering something value of, hey, if this was my money, how would I want it spent? And what would I want it spent on? And what would I want to see be delivered? And if you can take that mindset and really own what it is you're delivering, like you're going to be miles ahead of a lot of other people out there delivering this stuff, because it's your money and you're going to do things that are going to be really intelligent and you're going to become accountable and committed.
Well, I think those are really good, those sort of 6 points for summarizing what Agile is in a nutshell. I find the honesty in your book really good. You mentioned that not everyone necessarily likes working this way. Are you saying that Agile software development isn't for everyone?
Yeah, it's everyone wants what Agile gives, but there's a lot of people who aren't prepared to really make the sacrifice or have the discipline or have the mindset of working this way. I mean, there's a lot of people out there, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but there's just a lot of people like showing up to work, being told what to do and being left alone and just, you know, staying out of the way. And Agile is a very transparent, visible way of working. So if you're not comfortable with showing up every day and saying, hey, this is what I did yesterday, this is how I'm going to change the world today, and this is what you can expect from me. Some people just aren't sort of into that level of transparency when they're executing. So no, it's not a cure-all. It's not a silver bullet. A lot of people sometimes like to hide and stay on the down low under the radar. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. There could be a lot of reasons for doing that, but it is a very visible way of working. And I think it's a great place where you want your teams to get to, but not everyone necessarily jumps in the bandwagon when they see this coming down.
Now, myself, having spoken to friends who work in Agile shops, they love it. They absolutely love being able to go to work every day and put a dent in the universe and actually producing things. But I Now, I kind of have my own sort of perspective on this, and I kind of want to run it past you. It seems to me that to work in a successful agile shop, you need to have real buy-in from everybody involved, not just the manager who says, okay, everybody, we're going to do agile this week. You really almost have to have the programmers approach management and say, hey, we want to do development in this way. Is it, how important is it to have buy-in from all the focusing just on the development team?
You know, it's very important, and there's so many ways of looking at this. I mean, obviously, if you've got, you know, management and senior management really, really with their heart and souls bought into this process because they know they need to improve, or they know they need to, you know, react more quickly to what's going on in industry, that's a wonderful place to be, because they're going to empower you, they're going to champion you, and they're going to help remove roadblocks that are inherent in every organization when it comes to sometimes working this way. Having said that, however, just because, you know, maybe management isn't completely on board, or you've got some very senior old school people who aren't used to kicking off projects without creating the entire data model before day one, there are certain things you can do and take responsibility to just be more agile yourself. And the one I really encourage testers to do is that it just kills me every time I hear a developer say that our customers aren't giving enough time to test. Like when I hear that, I go, well, don't give them that option. I mean, testing is something that we need to do when we're delivering software. That's not something we should be negotiating with our business or customers. I mean, our customers are expecting us to test the software. So I think you need to take it upon yourself to make that happen. So having senior management bought in really helps, and it does affect how people work. So you're absolutely right. You do need the team, whoever's working on that project, to really be bought into the process, because it does change fundamentally how people work.
You mentioned also that there really is no one way to do agile.
Yes. That's, I think, one of the greatest myths and strengths and weaknesses. I'm an old school XP-er. So when XP Extreme Programming first came out, you know, me and like lots of other developers really latched onto that and thought that was great. But I think as Kent Beck and many others who were leading the agile movement discovered it, it isn't a one size fits all. It was a great stake in the ground. Like if you can, you know, do those 13 practices and really follow what's going on there, you're going to be, you know, very good things can happen. But it does need to be fit, you know, within the organization. Every project's going to be different. I mean, depending upon who you've got, what roles are going to be playing. I think the principles are really important, but it does need to be tailored because, you know, obviously a small, tight, co-located team is not going to need to have as much documentation or write everything down. As opposed to a very large distributed team, you're probably going to need a little more formality around some things. So it isn't a one size fits all. You just want to go basically as light as you can and only add on weight around process sort of when you need it, as opposed to the more, I'm not saying Rational Rose does this or something, but sort of a heavy process where you start with everything and then you try to peel it away. This is more of a start light and add just what you need.
Yeah. So there's like all these different terminologies out there that people, you know, Scrum and, One point that you touched on that was I related to, I came from the late 90s where I was really interested in lean manufacturing.
Right.
So you were throwing around terms like Kanban and Poka-Yoke and Muda and all this kind of stuff. And so when I started seeing XP and Agile, I almost felt like I got to throw my hand up in the room like, oh, this has all been done before. This is Toyota. It's like you're actually seeing that Agile is not so much. I want to hear your opinion on that. What do you think about all the?
You know, I completely understand where you're coming from. Of course, me being sort of a younger guy in the late 90s, it was all new to me. So I thought, oh, this is wonderful. This is the way to do it around extreme programming. And had I been maybe a couple years older and I was exposed to more lean manufacturing, I would have been exactly in what you're saying. Actually, I almost came to the lean part after doing XP for a while when Kanban came out and they're sort of saying, you know, limit your work in process and, you know, the pull system and all that. I was like, well, that's already built into a lot of what we do in XP. So I was kind of like, where's the beef? Like, I'm not seeing anything different here. So I understand how those people feel sometimes. When it comes to Agile, I literally feel that at its core, everyone gets it because, and this is what I love about the way Kent describes it is, it's literally nothing more than what you do when you're faced with this problem of too much to do and not enough time. That's really what it comes down to. In every project, you've got too much to do and not enough time. So how do you deal with it? And the metaphor I like to share with people is, well, what do you do in a busy weekend when you got too much to do and not enough time? You probably make a list. You probably prioritize things. You either intrinsically or extrinsically size things up to just see how big these things are. And then you start executing and updating the plan as you go, because you might hit traffic on the highway. You may not be able to get to Dairy Queen to pick up the ice cream cake, and you got three kids to drop off at hockey. So people are inherently agile in their everyday life. I think all we're doing, all we're saying in software is do the same thing, because what else can you do really?
Well, one of the things that you run into, of course, is especially in a place that's very process heavy and say waterfall, you have sort of the idea of traditional job descriptions. You know, this is my job and this is, your, you know, you're the developer, they're the QA person, his usability. Agile teams tend to blur the lines with that. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the greatest challenges when you're introducing Agile into, say, a very institutionalized or very set way where roles are clearly defined, people are siloed. That's a great challenge. I mean, one of the challenges I had with Scrum coming in was, you know, you could come in hard with a Scrum message of there are no roles. And you could just leave it right there. Like, the team has to self-discover, self-organize, figure out how they're going to execute. And while I believe and back the idea of what that metaphor is it's hard to come into an organization and suddenly take everyone in the development area and say, there are no roles now. So something, the way I try to explain it is there are roles on Agile projects. Like, all this, all the same work still gets done. It's just how it gets done is a little bit different. So just to take QA, like, QA is no longer now one group or one person's responsibility. And people would get this. It's obviously now a team responsibility. It starts with analysis. It starts with development. It starts with the project manager. It starts with anyone who sees anything that can improve the quality of a product. That's really a team responsibility. So you never want to hear, how did that bug slip through QA? You know, the team should be asking, how do we as a team move that bug? So that's one that blurs. But also when it comes to even analysis or usability and design, depending upon who you've got, more than one person can play that role. I mean, in one extreme, if you've got a one-person project, obviously they're going to be doing analysis, development, testing, and UX. Like, that sounds obvious with one person. But if you've got an analyst with a flair for setting expectations, they may be able to do some project management. If you've got passionate developers who really want to kick butt, they're going to be wanting to test, obviously. And the same with QA. They know they're going to be able to write better tests if they're involved in the analysis. So all those things kind of blur. And depending upon who you've got, what strengths they have, and what they're passionate about playing in terms of roles will really dictate how you're going to execute. And that's the one thing I think, like, I personally chafe against, is I even have a hard time describing people, myself to people, just as a developer. Like, well, what is that? Like, because I'm passionate about testing. I know I'm going to write better code if I really, really study and become better at testing. I'm furiously interested in UX design right now, because when I'm building products, I know how I space, how I lay out the text, the writing, the copy I put in that landing page. That's really going to matter. So that some people like to work that way. And I'm not saying it's for everyone. Like, we don't all have to be generalists, but I think we've all got great strengths that we'd be crazy not to leverage when we're delivering software. So if you've got it, I say use it.
How important is it for the customer to be involved? Are they essentially part of the team?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And there's no faster way to really derail or waste a lot of time without having some strong leadership and someone who can really set the direction around what the product needs to do around requirements and things like that. So that's an absolutely huge role. It can be delegated, but whoever it's delegated to has to really be empowered, because the team's going to come to these people with a ton of questions. You know, what does this screen need to look like? How does validation work on these fields? We can either do it this way or this way. What do you think we need to do? And if you don't have someone on the team day to day on the ground helping make those, you know, giving the team quick turnaround to those types of questions, just to bring in the lean metaphor, you're going to have a lot of waste. You're going to have a lot of, you know, emails just sitting there stale. You're going to have slow turnaround on things. And I've literally seen it just kill projects. And so it's a very, very important role.
Now, that might scare some business people, the idea that, you know, having to work with the developers every day. This isn't an ideal world where the business people don't really want to talk to the developers. The developers don't really want to talk to the business people. How does, you know, that alone seems to be quite a challenge. How do you?
Yeah, sure. What I would say to that is, look, if you guys don't want to sit together every day, that's fine. do as much as you can. Just understand what you're giving up if you aren't communicating effectively. And this is all, I mean, this was sort of some of the pushback I think extreme programming got in the early days from teams. And quite rightly, we can't afford or we don't have business people who are available to sit full time with our developers. Does that mean we cannot do XP? And obviously the answer is no. All XP highlighted is just understand the closer you bring the people who need the software to the people who are actually building it, the better your product is going to be. That's all they're saying. So get as close as you can comfortably. If you can co-locate someone, or you've got someone who can spend a couple hours every day with the team, or you've got some kind of way of having those tight feedback loops, because it's all about feedback, you're going to have a lot more ability to steer and create the product you want. That's sort of the pitch to business. Because you're going to, the very act of creating software changes the requirements. That's the one thing like a lot of people don't realize is when I build that first screen and I put it in front of you, you're going to change your mind because you're actually going to see what you want. Or even worse, the customer may not know what they want until we put some options in front of them and then they can steer. So the closer you can get that really tight collaboration going, the better. But again, it's not a one size fits all. And sometimes you do have people either not co-located, they are on different floors of the office building, or they are offsite. So then you just do your best. And you just understand though, the principle of the closer you can work together, the better it's going to be.
When you talk in your book about accountability and empowerment of a team, what does that look like? How do you make a team accountable and how do you empower them?
Very, very, very good question. I didn't really understand empowerment and accountability until I really went and did my first honest to goodness startup, where I realized that at the end of the day, it's not a manager, it's not a VP, it's not a director, it's not anyone else who's accountable and responsible for this. It's literally me and this team of comrades and peers I've got around me. And after executing and failing at a startup, but being left with that empowerment feeling, when I brought that when I went back and started consulting in the enterprise, it really, really helped me just deliver fantastic results. Like the people I was working for just loved how this team would come here and just own a problem. They would see a problem, they would take initiative, they would just solve it. They would just own it entirely. They didn't have to be told, they didn't have to be guided, they didn't have to be berated, they just did it. And that was just a wonderful way to work. It's just served me very well. So transforming that now into say large companies and enterprises, one of the greatest ways I find to foster that level of accountability is just make the people who are building the software, the development team, show up once a week and just demo what they've built to the people who are spending the money, the customers. It's a very quick way to get developers and the team on board that when you show up for that demo, things had better work. You better have the demo up and running. You had better deployed it to the server. You had better done a dry run to make sure that everything's, you know, lined up. You better be able to answer some questions. If there's something that's dicey, you may want to set expectations ahead of time. But you only need a couple really bad demos in front of your customers before teams suddenly, it's really an inflection point in the project. Either they get it and they become accountable or they don't, in which case you've got a bigger problem.
That must really scare the daylight.
Yeah, but they get it very, very quickly. And it's a great way to just see who's on board and who isn't.
Well, your book, you know, when I'm reading it, it's very hard to describe other than it just reads almost like a novel. You know, you're throwing in little pieces of advice here and there along the way. And one of the quotes in there is you say when you're hiring a team, you look for people who don't panic when curveballs are thrown at them and who can take a punch and who can deal with the change train as comes rolling down the track. gosh, that, you know, that seems like an awfully good job description.
Yeah. Well, it's really just I'm really just trying to set expectations with folks when they start working this way, or even if they don't, when you're just working. I mean, just look where we are today. You know, like 5 or 6 years ago, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no iPhone. I mean, the rate of change and the impact it's having on how we work today is just phenomenal, phenomenally exciting because it's so fun to try to stay abreast and on top of all these technologies. I mean, we couldn't do what we were doing 10 years ago here, like podcasting like this and being able to distribute this around the internet. Like it's just amazing. So change is coming faster than ever. And I'm just really trying to set the expectation. You want people who are just cool with change. And I think a lot of the younger generation is, if I just can call them the Gen Ys for a second, like when they see Agile, the ones I've worked with, they kind of go, Like, well, of course, what else would you do? Like, they just understand that things are constantly changing. There's always a new phone coming out, or they have to react to something different. It's sometimes the people who are more used to creating that Gantt chart, having a critical path, when something doesn't go according to plan, they're like, what do we do? Like, just chill. Like, and that's why I really, in the beginning of the book, I try to call out those three principles that I believe every project is run by, which is, one, look, you're not going to gather all the requirements in the beginning, so don't even try. Like, get the most you can, but understand you're not going to have them all. So just relax on that point. Second, they're going to change. From the second day you start the project, your requirements are going to change. So just expect that. And thirdly, understand you're always going to have more to do than time and money allow. And that's okay. Like, that's the normal state of any remotely interesting project. And once you accept that, and you can sort of manage these expectations from that base, like, you can just relax then, because not relax from an executing point of view, but you just relax that you're not worried about change anymore because you know it's coming. And I just try to help set that kind of tone and create that kind of culture.
You know, I want to just kind of pause and reflect on those three truths that you call of agile development.
Sure.
Number one, it's impossible to gather all the requirements.
It is.
At the beginning. Number two, whatever the requirements you do gather, they're going to change. And number three, there will always be more to do than time and money will allow. That's how all projects are, according to what you're saying.
It is. It is. And it's absolutely like, I mean, it's like my secret sauce kind of when I go into a project, because once you know those things are going to happen, you just don't get overly excited when a irate VP or unrealistic CEO comes in and starts pounding the table and saying, making ridiculous demands that you and the team know just can't be met. And it's just a great way for helping heal, I feel, the dysfunctional relationship and really poor expectation setting we've sort of given business over the years, which is, you know, this mantra of work, plan the work the plan, on time, on budget. I mean, really, who cares if no one likes the software? Like, if no one's going to use it, like I understand on time and on budget are important. And I think one of our root causes of that is the annual budgeting process. But parking that for now, it's just a wonderful way to sort of, as a development team, put the ball back in your customer's court or the people who have the money and just go, look, we've got a shopping list of stuff we could buy here with your money. You've helped us prioritize these things. This is great. This is how fast we're going. This is when it looks like we're going to be done. And this is the stuff that looks like it's going to fit into our jar of limited capacity. And this is the stuff that's not going to fit. So you cool with that. So absolutely, you're going to discover new things. You can bring things on. But if we're going to stick to the date, we've got to flex somewhere. So we like to flex on scope. And if you don't want to flex on scope, that's fine. We're just going to have to wiggle the date, obviously, just like you would do in a long weekend, given something else to do. So it's just a very cool way of operating a project. You don't need the drama. You don't need the dysfunction. You don't need the command control, cracking the whip. These guys got to work harder, pizza under the door. Like, no, we want to write software as if we had enough time to do it right and make sure that what we're producing is good. We could roll into production if we had to. And we're proud of what we're doing, and we're excited to come in and know that we're going to do a good job every day and serve our customers well.
Now, one thing that kind of comes out through the book when I'm reading this, I'm like, man, this guy has been there. You really know this stuff. I want to touch on something you actually admitted. You mentioned that you had a gas accounting system project fail. Can you?
Yeah.
I don't know how far. I don't know how open you want to be with this.
But no. I mean, I won't obviously use names, but obviously, like, people love horror stories, right? Like, that's just something I find they love.
Okay, I admit they love watching
train wrecks. So this, sure, I'll tell you, this was one where, you know, admittedly, we made some mistakes in this project. We came in, and we didn't do a good job setting expectations. I mean, the customer heard of Agile. They were looking for a silver bullet. And our sales force said, yeah, we got it. Here it is. It's Agile. So we came and started doing it. But what happened was we'd keep going to our iteration planning meetings, and the customer PM of the project would keep insisting we deliver a certain amount every 2 weeks, like 500 points worth of stuff. And our velocity, or how we were tracking, was 300. Like, so obviously there's a big gap there. And I joined the project about midway or kind of later on. But when I arrived and I saw this, I was like, guys, we can't let this keep going. So finally, it came to a head, and we just refused to accept 500 points worth of work for a 2 week period where we know we could do 300, where we were already working overtime, trying to get the project back on track. And we were already late and we already had some real challenges. And, after that meeting, I was quietly pulled aside and just said, you know, we appreciate your contribution, but we think it'd be better if you weren't here right now, because I wasn't helping create the culture they thought they needed, which was a real, just do what you're told and accept that this is what it's going to be. And basically they told me, you just upset, or you just ruined the relationship we had with our customers that we took over your building. And I was like, well, I certainly don't want to be the guy who ruined the relationship with your customer, because they'd basically been telling their customers certain things and I wasn't towing the line there. So I was asked to leave. Very tough project. Our guys worked so hard on that to deliver. And in the end, it was still a failure because we let the client down from a certain point of view. We didn't manage expectations well. We delivered in the end, but it wasn't a fun project at all. We had some guys actually leave the company after that because they didn't like the hours they were working. So it was a failure all around, basically. But it's not something I was proud of, and I do not blame the customer entirely. We definitely made some mistakes there, but that was one where if you're in an organization that's run from a very top down, you know, this is the date, this is the budget, and if it's a $2 million project and you've got $800,000 to do it, something's going to give. Unfortunately, when it's the team that's delivering where things have to give, that's where reality hits. And that's where the lies sort of break down and reality trickles up. And no one wanted to hear that reality trickle up. So that was a tough message.
Well, Jonathan, you've got your battle scars.
I definitely do.
You've got your credentials to say that, you know, you've agile to you is not some sort of airy-fairy, touchy-feely thing. I mean, you've really got it down concrete. And one of the tools, you know, when you talk, that probably came out of these sort of things, you talk about something called an inception deck. What is an inception deck?
Oh, yeah. Is it important? It's this tool has saved my bacon more than once on a project. This is something that came out of ThoughtWorks, basically, where we were going into gigs and realizing that we weren't setting our projects up for success as well as we could have when we were starting. And it was a gentleman by the name of Robin Gibson, an Australian, who put together the first version of the deck. It was basically 10 slides, just really listing 10 questions you'd be crazy not to get clarification on before you start your project. And it's a wonderful way just to really get alignment, make sure everyone's on the bus. And it's really like, you know, at the beginning of a project, it's kind of like taking a flashlight and going into a haunted house. Like, and you want to do this in the beginning because this is your time to really ask the tough questions. You know, so you want to go in there with that flashlight and look for cobwebs, look for skeletons, look for anything that's going to help you either execute better or set expectations around, you know, risk, or you really want to know that stuff as much as you can up front. I mean, obviously you're never going to know anything, everything, but if you can just go in and just make sure the team understands why they're here, why the company is spending valuable shareholder capital in this project in the first place, what's not in scope, just as important as what's in, and just go through a series of exercises, you can really, really do yourself some justice. And it addresses that one area I mentioned earlier, project chartering, in a very light, agile style manner. I mean, an inception deck can take anywhere from a day to about a week to create. It's good for about 3 to 6 months of planning, but it doesn't have to be a 6 to 3 month, navel-gazing exercise. You can do this very quickly. Get everyone aligned, make sure everyone understands the technology, the architecture, this is what we're building, this is not what we're building, this is what's in scope, this is not what's in scope, here's what it's going to take, this is the kind of team. It's a wonderful way just to set yourself up for success. Because really, if there's something you need, you want to ask for that in the beginning, because it's too late to sort of call it out when the bomb's already gone off sort of later in the project.
You know, Jonathan, I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you made a book that gives some very concrete advice, yet is able to roll with the punches and able to say, hey, you know what? Everything in this book is not necessarily gospel. You can take what you need, leave aside. But there is some really deep, well thought out advice in this book. And it was just such a fascinating read. One of the things you even talk about, one of the greatest lies in our industry that has been perpetuated for over the last 40 years. Can you touch what that is?
I'm trying to think about where I think. It's basically, is it that unrealistic plan?
The idea that scope and flexibility aren't going to change.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to keep...
I think the notion that... So it's easy to pick on waterfall, because it's been with us for so long, and obviously we know how to do things much better now. The reason why I don't like being overly critical of Waterfall is because I think it was a wonderful model for the way we used to have to develop software back in like the 60s.
At the time.
At the time. I mean, setting aside that the original Waterfall paper actually recommended you do this more than once, setting that aside and setting aside the history of the American military adopting it, the French, the Germans, the British adopting it, the American military abandoning it, but then industry looking to the military who was writing a lot of software on how to do things. I mean, from a big business billable point of view, Waterfall works very well because you can send people onto a client site and have them just gather requirements for half a year or 2 years.
And you got to remember, this is back in the days when you didn't have email.
That's right. That's right.
You didn't have voicemail.
No, you had none of these things. I mean, I was watching Superman the other day, the original Superman, Christopher Reeves, and everyone's smoking and using typewriters. And that doesn't seem that long ago, but that's where it was. And back then, you know, change was very expensive. So I'm not sure if anyone's ever seen that cost of change curve, but if you can change a requirement in the requirements gathering phase of your project, that might cost a buck. And obviously changing a requirement right before you go to production might cost $1,000 or $10,000, like orders of magnitude more expensive. So when you had punch cards, and not every developer had a just-in-time compiler, a relational database, phenomenally powerful computers with the internet and Google at your disposal, you could understand why they would try to drive a lot of change out of what they were doing back then. So that's why I don't come down on them too hard. What's changed, obviously, now is we're in a completely different world. And this is where XP sort of came in and challenged this notion that change has to be expensive later on in the project. In other words, if there's things we can do when we're writing software in terms of regression testing, working in smaller chunks, continuous integration, co-locating the business with the dev team, we might be able to challenge that cost of change curve and accept change a lot later in the process. So the great lie, of course, is that it's an exponentially scalable curve right now. Like, that's not necessarily true. Like, you look at any startup or any company that needs to build something, the way they can pivot these days and get that feedback incorporated in and build something that their customers really want, it's going to have a great advantage. So, yeah, the idea that everything is fixed, like scope, time, budget, like nothing's fixed. I mean, I remember going onto an Agile project for an extremely regulated utility where they came in, and this is utility, so they have to go to the taxpayers of the province for money for the project. And they said, everything here is fixed. The perfect project for us is one that spends the last dollar at 11:59 p.m. on the last day. That's the perfect project for them. But you know things are going to change. So the challenge, because they wanted to get this out fast, they were under the gun, is we just had to set up a process that allowed them to show the change in a way that was okay for the auditors. And it worked out fine because guess what? The first version of the product we built, we put in front of the customer and they said, this is great, but you know, we're coming from a Unix system and we're going to a Windows-based system now. There's some things in there we can do that we couldn't do before. So would you mind using a tab instead of three green screens? So change is always coming. And that's why I always kind of smile a little bit whenever I hear the data set, the money set, the project set, the budget set, everything set. It's like, you can set it, but something's always going to give. So that's what I think those are the fun projects.
Well, your book, The Agile Samurai, How Agile Masters Deliver Great Software, fantastic read. I really suggest that people get it, not just for the developers and for the people on the team, but get it for the customer and get it for people that haven't really, you know, who just want a good overview. It's not a really long book, too. It's really quite readable. Did you make that a goal to try and not make it, you know, ramble on and on and on?
We have wonderful editors at the Prags, the Pragmatic Programmers, and Susanna Falser did a wonderful job. I mean, it's hard sometimes when you spend 6 months on a section and you have to reduce 100 pages down to 40. But when you do, it's such a better experience and product for the end customer. And that's we've had to do that in the book. And what you're left with is just the absolute diamonds, the absolute best stuff. There's almost no, I can't think of any fluff in here.
No,
and
it's really not.
We worked very hard to keep it under 250 pages. So it's not a huge weight on you when you're carrying it around.
Excellent job. A really, really fantastic read.
Thanks, Miles.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Pragmatic Podcast, a production of the Pragmatic Programmers. Visit us at pragprog.com for your copy of The Agile Warrior by Jonathan Rasmussen. As well, check out our selection of books, screencasts, and don't forget to pick up your free copy of our monthly PragPub magazine. That's the Pragmatic Programmers, at pragprog.com.